Hey everyone, it's Noah,
Marissa,
and Tommy, and welcome back to our podcast, Peace, Police, and Everything in Between. In mid-August, the three of us sat down on Zoom with Lucia Harmo, the Deputy Director of the Lower Hudson Valley, New York Civil Liberties Union.
And our conversation with her was truly fascinating. We covered a wide range of topics, including local policing here in Westchester, legislation being passed upstate in Albany, and we even had her respond to some questions from the Kol Ami youth group.
You'll hear all about her life and background in our conversation. But before we listen to that, we want to tell everyone a bit about our fantastic guest. Deputy Director Harmo is the daughter of two immigrants from Spain and has been a fierce advocate for many years on a whole range of issues. She's been with the ACLU for over a decade, working first in the national office and then in Alabama and now here in Westchester.
So here's our conversation with Deputy Director Harmo of the NYCLU. We hope you all enjoy it.
Deputy Director Harmo, we've really been looking forward to today. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me. Excited to be here.
So before we dive into policing, could we discuss your background? And more specifically, could you discuss the way that your background has influenced the work you do?
Well, I grew up in New Jersey, so not too far from New York. And I grew up as a daughter of Spanish immigrants. My parents were always very involved with the immigrant community. My mother's a teacher and really instilled in me a sense of pride of being from an immigrant family. I got to see a lot of the struggles that immigrants face in the United States, but also being someone who's immigrated from Spain, being someone who's white and whose parents were college educated, I had a lot of privilege. My parents were U.S. citizens also. My grandparents were undocumented, but my parents were U.S. citizens. And so that gave me with a sense of opening my eyes to the world around me, but also recognizing that I have a lot of privilege that was able to give me such a great and incredible life that I have. So one of the things I was always kind of a little bit of, I spoke out a lot in my high school growing up. And so I was always someone who liked to speak out. And so I kind of gravitated towards activism work. That was something that I really wanted to help give back and also just help care for people and create community and create connections wherever I went. So I went to American University, studied international relations, and then got more into kind of national advocacy work when I started working at the ACLU. I spent 6 years in Alabama, which as someone who had spent very little time in the South was an eye-opening experience also. Worked on a lot of different issues, learned how to change the way that I do organizing, depending on the community that I'm with. Organizing in the South is super robust. There's a lot of creativity that happens, but it can be different from organizing in the North. So I learned how to really listen to folks who are impacted, how to take leadership from them, and how to do my best to consistently be an anti-racist. And now I'm here in New York. I've been here for a little over a year now, and am really focusing on getting to know the Hudson Valley, my new home, Westchester and Rockland, and figuring out the players here and how I can be helpful.
So we want to get to the policing part of this podcast. You mentioned the differences you saw between organizing down in Alabama and up here in New York. Could you maybe talk a little bit about the similarities and differences that you see in law enforcement between these two states?
Sure, yeah. So it's not as different as folks would think, most likely. I mean, Alabama is very different in the fact that there's a supermajority of Republicans in the legislature, and there's a lot of lack of services. So I think that the issues that you see here in New York can sometimes be heightened in Alabama. There isn't as much access to services for housing, for food, for domestic violence services. And also Alabama is very into criminalization. So criminalizes people very heavily for very minor offenses. For example, in Alabama, having a personal amount of marijuana, if you're caught a second time, that's a felony. Here, it's been decriminalized for a very long time. So there's differences on that, but I think there's also a lot of similarities. Police are still very much heavily focused in low-income areas, are still practicing racialized policing. There's a lot of use of force in both states. And also New York does a lot of prosecuting minor offenses and policing on minor offenses. So I think there are issues that you could see from both. And in Montgomery, there was a man, unfortunately, who was killed by a cop, Greg Gunn, and that cop was actually arrested and was charged. And he was one of the only police who had been charged with killing someone. Then in Birmingham, there was someone who was killed where the cops were not arrested at all. So it's a little bit of a give and take, where it's sometimes a little bit different, but we see the same issues in policing in Alabama as we do here in New York.
So, Director, on the topic of policing, the NYCLU has declared a support for the movement to defund the police. So what exactly does the NYCLU mean by defunding the police?
So we, as the NYCLU, have fought for many years on police reform. We have worked with communities, we've fought to pass bills, some of those bills have passed, and I think that we've made a few strides in increasing transparency for police, trying to increase accountability, and passing laws that we think that will be helpful. From what we're seeing, those laws are not as effective as we'd like to be. We're nowhere near where we'd like to be on policing here in New York. So I think it's time, especially with a change of momentum and with the unfortunate economic realities that we're facing, that we need to change our tactics. And what we're seeing right now is that as budget crises happen, social services are the first on the chopping block. And police budgets are massive compared to other services that are provided. So what that means is that we're not addressing problems at the root. We're addressing problems when they're already escalated. And when someone is facing a mental health crisis or a crisis with addiction or a crisis with violence in the home, the person who shows up is an armed person who is not trained to de-escalate. Even the presence of police, I, as a very privileged white person, if I see a cop car on the side of the road, I start to get nervous. And that happens to a lot of people. And so when the police show up, that's a natural escalation that's happening. So we need to reimagine, we need to rework how we're seeing policing and what jobs the police are doing. And also that means that we need to adequately fund the work. And as we're seeing with coronavirus, the need has skyrocketed. They're now saying that 500,000 people in Westchester County are food insecure. A county of 1 million people, 500,000 are food insecure. And as we're going through this economic downturn, there's naturally going to be people who want to cut those services. And that just cannot happen. So we need to see where the budget are higher, and we need to work on defunding the police and pushing that into social services so we can address problems at the root.
So a lot of people say that defunding the police will actually lead to an increase of crime in our communities, since there will be a decreased presence of law enforcement officials. How do you respond to that sort of thought?
Yeah, I think sometimes when people hear the word defund the police, they think that the goal is to completely defund tomorrow without any safety net or anything else that is coming up to replace it. What we really see is that a lot of the crime that happens, the police right now spend only 5% of their time on the most violent offenses. The other 95% of their time is for prosecuting low-level offenses or going after and policing low-level offenses. So I think what we need to see with a lot of those low-level offenses, a lot of the root issue can be traced back to desperation, can be traced back to a mental illness, to addiction issues, to not having the support and the care in their own communities to be able to address what is really going on with this person. And so I think defunding the police is going to be something that requires a lot of care, requires a lot of attention. And requires us to make sure that we have adequate safety nets that are actually caring for families instead of breaking them and tearing them apart. No one is cured by throwing someone into jail for a month. They're not cured of their addiction issues that way. They're not cured of their mental health issues. They're not given support to access food or housing, so they're not in such desperate situations. And so what we're really talking about with defunding the police is a radical reimagining of where we shift our priorities. Because budgets, really, their priorities, they showcase the priorities that we have in our county. Right now, we're putting our priority in policing and criminalization. We're not putting our priority into taking care of families and communities who live here in Westchester. And that's really what we mean by defund the police. And that if we do that and we do it in a measured and a calculated way, we're going to be able to build healthier communities that don't require the use of police as much as they do right now.
So in an ideal world, how would you visualize the police budget being reinvested? What sort of social services do you see this money going towards?
So it's a little tricky to answer that because I think the answer really has to come from the impacted community members who are experiencing the bulk of the issues, and it's going to change depending on every municipality, every town. Westchester has, I believe, 43 different police departments in the county, so it's going to look different. We'll have to take a look at the budgets that are happening, how much is spent on police, how much is spent on social services, and how we can change that. And I think that's a little bit of the sticking point, is that there's not really one answer that you could point to. Well, if we increase our spending in this one program, automatically we're going to see a return on that. We have to look at what are the issues that are happening in that specific community? Where do folks want to see their dollars invested? And where can we cut from that? But I think that the overall trend that we've been seeing is that police departments do not get their budget cut at all when other places that provide services get their budget cut and slashed, and they have to make do with that. So that's what we kind of want to shift the thinking of. I think a lot of good could be done in mobile crisis health units. So if someone is having a mental health crisis emergency, that someone who is trained and does not have a gun shows up at those situations. If we help to address the huge housing crisis in Westchester, we're not going to have as many folks who don't have homes and then are not approached by police for sleeping on a bench or for loitering or for doing any of those things that might now be crimes, but are really just come down to this person doesn't have a place to live. They don't have a place to be right now. Food insecurity is something that is desperately needed for us to get more resources towards, because if folks have food in their homes, they're able to care for their families better. You know, that's just one of the things of the hierarchy of needs, is that we need to be able to have food, access to food, reliable access to food, and housing. And so I think those things will be really helpful in the long run for Westchester.
We're going to take a quick break, but we'll be back in a moment with more of Peace, Police, and Everything in Between.
At this point, we started talking with Deputy Director Irmo about some of the legislation that was passed in recent months in our state legislature. Let's listen to that part of our conversation.
Let's shift the focus here a little bit to the tactics that the police use. So since the death of George Floyd, New York State has passed numerous police reform bills and legislation, including the repeal of Section 50A, which protects the records of law enforcement officials, firefighters, paramedics, also a ban on chokeholds, and many more pieces of legislation. And can you talk a little bit about how some of these measures will, you know, manifest themselves and what their effects will be?
Yeah, we'll definitely see, because the repeal of 50A and the STAT Act are ones that we have been working on for a really long time. The repeal of 50A increases transparency. It was actually one of the most opaque laws in the entire country where you could not have access to police's disciplinary records. As we saw with the killing of George Floyd, that officer had multiple disciplinary records. And if the public had known about that, or if the police department had actually done something about that, maybe George Floyd would be alive today. But in New York, we wouldn't have had any access to that information. And for the STAT Act, that means that when someone is arrested or charged with a misdemeanor or violation, or when anyone who dies in police custody or an attempt to establish custody, New York State would capture and report the race, ethnicity, and sex of that person. These are important strides, but as you see, it's all about transparency and information. Now the next step is what we're gonna do with that information and if it's actually going to change the police department. So we can have a bunch of statistics that showcase, that might showcase that the police is heavily arresting people of one race or heavily arresting people of one sex. If we don't do anything with that information, it's just gonna stay the same. Same with the police disciplinary records. It's a great step that now we have access to those records and we're able to see, if we FOIL and we ask for the information, we're able to see which cops in our own police departments have extensive disciplinary records and which ones might not, should probably not be on the force. But if that's all we see is the disciplinary record, there's nothing that comes from that, the same issues are going to happen. So I think the next step to these, this is really information gathering and transparency. Now we have to use that for advocacy and we have to use that to shift fundamentally our policing systems.
So these measures are clearly great strides towards police reform, but there's still so much more that needs to be done. What other legislation would the NYCLU like to see passed at the state level?
One thing with the STAT Act, although we're very happy that it passed, one thing that we would have liked to include on that was information on people who have not only been arrested, but who have been stopped by the police. Because as we know, a decent amount of policing is stopping and asking, and a lot of those interactions don't result in an arrest. So what we really want to see is who police are interacting with, and how and in what areas and to what races are they over-policing. And so that's something that I think would be interesting to pass an update on that. And then I think just next year, we're really going to have to struggle with the budget. We're really going to have to figure out, with everything that's happening, there is so much need in our county, in our state, and the funding is going to be running dry, and we need to figure out how to change that. We also have a bill that we were hoping would pass this session, but unfortunately couldn't get to that, that would curtail the use of drones by police. So police would need search warrants in order to activate drones. So we saw that a lot with the protests that are happening, that police are flying drones all over. It's an intimidation tactic. It's something that is mass widespread surveillance, and it's something that we oppose. So we really want to push this bill that's called the Protect Our Privacy Act next session. We also want to work on banning facial recognition technology. Facial recognition technology has already been shown to be very biased. There are many reports of people who are picked up by crimes because facial recognition technology is not able to work as well on people with darker skin. And so that is just racism and technology right there. And so the fact that we're using that, we should really be getting rid of that. And then the last thing that we'll be pushing is might be a little bit more of a local action, but we really want to make sure that we get cops out of school, that cops in schools generally have not been shown to increase safety, but have been shown to increase the school to prison pipeline, so increase the criminalization of students. It also increases the fear of undocumented students, increases the likelihood that they might have an interaction with ICE. And we need counselors in our schools. We don't need cops. Schools are there to educate students and to take care of students. We don't need criminalization there.
So how does the NYCLU fit into advocating for all these reforms, and what do you guys sort of do to try and get these passed?
So we do kind of, the three main areas that we work in are in the courts, the communities, and the legislature. So for legislative advocacy, we have some folks who are in Albany who are talking with their elected officials. I talk with elected officials here in the Hudson Valley, try to establish those relationships and really figure out how we can get laws passed. The legal aspect is, you know, if there's a law that is unconstitutional or is applied unconstitutionally, we take them to court. But a lot of what my job is and a lot of what spurs this legislative advocacy is the community work. So we want to make sure that folks are engaged and active in changing their communities, changing their local communities, their county communities, and their state communities. And so we want to be a resource for folks who are interested in these issues, are engaged in advocacy. We also want to make sure that we're uplifting the work of folks who are on the ground, because we're not a direct organizing organization. We work in the communities to make sure that people know their rights, and we work with other groups. But we want to make sure that the solutions for what we're going to do to change policing come from the folks who are most directly impacted, and that we take the leadership from them. So a lot of the work is going to look differently in every locality, because we want to make sure that we're taking that that leadership from other.
We're going to take another short pause, but stay tuned. We will be right back with more of our discussion with Deputy Director Herman.
About 2 months ago, we sent out a survey to the Kolami Youth Group, asking everyone to submit questions for our guests on this podcast. For the final portion of this episode, we took some of those questions that you guys sent in and relayed them to Deputy Director Hermo, word for word. Let's listen to some of her responses.
So I'm just going to switch focus a little bit and ask a question straight from the survey we sent out. One of the most common questions we received was, what can people under the voting age do to work for police reform? As an advocate who specializes in organizing, what do you say to high schoolers who are trying to speak up, and what can they do to make change?
That's a great question, and I love answering it. So the first thing that I think high schoolers can do to make change is to make change in your own school. So if you have a school resource officer, if you have something in your school that you don't like, that's a great way to start to make change, because in your school, you know the decision makers. You can petition with state boards, you can get classmates together and start groups. That's actually how I got my start in advocacy. Is I started a gay straight alliance in my school, and it really taught me how to do advocacy, and now I get paid to do it, which is amazing. So it really is a way to learn your skills. I got comfortable speaking to people, facilitating, getting people together. We pushed to have a training for teachers on trans issues, trans and gender nonconforming issues. We got a lot of local schools together for a local summit that we did. And it was just, there's a tremendous amount of ability for high school students to make change within their own schools. So that's one way that you can get involved. I've also been seeing a lot of the protests that have been happening are being organized by high schoolers. So even though if you're under the age to vote, you can still organize protests. You can go volunteer with a group that you think is great. A lot of groups will need some support on social media, on doing communications work. That is something that is a perfect place for high schoolers to get involved. You can also just be reaching out to your legislative officials. Even if you're under 18, you're going to turn 18 at some point. So why not just build that relationship now so that you have it? I think that A lot of spotlight is put on voting advocacy, but there's a ton of people who can't vote. There are folks in our communities who are undocumented. There are folks in our communities who are under 18. And so there are multiple ways that you can make your voice heard. You can go to rallies, sign petitions, speak at public forums. You don't need to be a U.S. citizen to speak at a public forum. And so I think that's a lot of ways that folks can get involved. And I think I had another one, but it's leaving my mind, so I'll come back to it later. So
so another question that was common in the survey, and also just in other events and things that I've heard, revolved around the idea of what should I do as a privileged person to help those who aren't as privileged and to help fight
the injustices that we see in systems like our police system. So what do people of privilege have to do to fight these injustices?
Also a great question. I think there's a few different things that privileged people can do and things that I've done personally also. The first thing is to examine your privilege and to really recognize the racist history of the country that we live in, of the systems that have been built. They've all been built off of criminalization. They've all been built off of racism and built to support the system of white supremacy. And we need to be honest about that in our history. We can't move forward unless we look at our history and we recognize that our country was built on genocide, slavery, and white supremacy. That's just an unfortunate reality of living right now, and we need to be able to do it. There's a lot of resources that are out. I would recommend to follow Black-led and Indigenous-led organizations who will be pushing a lot of narratives that you don't see in the media. But also recognizing that just because you are in a system of white supremacy, you might not yourself be a racist, but by participating in that system, there unfortunately are going to be some times where you engage in racist actions. We've all done it. It's happened in my past too, and it's something that I actively work to think about. Okay, if I'm engaging in this space, how much space am I taking up? Is there someone else who can talk about this better? If I'm in a new space and I think that I have a great new idea, I actually just wait for a second to see, and usually someone else brings it up, or someone else brings up an even better idea that I had never thought of, because that person has lived experience, and so they know what is going on in that area in a way that I just never can. It's uncomfortable work, especially at first, but it's something that's really important. So if you read kind of books like How to Be an Anti-Racist, watch the documentary 13th. One of our deputy legal directors, Jeff Robinson, has a really fantastic talk about the history of racism in the United States. It's very long, but it's incredibly engaging. And so that's on YouTube. And he's coming out with a documentary at some point also. And I think if the more knowledge that we can get about exactly how many centuries our country has spent protecting white supremacy, the more that you could see that in your everyday systems of even when you're speaking up at a meeting, you might have a lot more entitlement than someone else in that room. And so another thing about recognizing privilege is to take your ego out of it. And that is sometimes hard because, you know, all of our lives are centered around ourselves. So we want to make sure to separate that. And to say, okay, someone might be pushing back against something I say. They're not pushing back against me as a person. They're pushing back against something that I've done. And I have to recognize that that might have harmed someone, even though I didn't intend it. It's uncomfortable. I recommend all privileged people to get outside of their comfort zones in appropriate places. You know, don't go to a trans support group if you're not trans or anything like that. But try to find and build relationships with folks that you are not, that you might not be comfortable with, because that is going to be helpful. And to do it in a respectful way that really minimizes harm. Another way that we could just recognize that we have a lot of power. So there might be some times where we're able to make connections with folks that other people are not. So we have to do what we can, and to do it in a way that separates our ego and minimizes the amount of harm that we do. It's important work, and it's not really, there's no real, it can be uncomfortable, but that's, you know, that's where you change, that's where you get better, is outside of your comfort zone.
What do you say to people who respond to Black Lives Matter by saying Blue Lives Matter and All Lives Matter?
I think that there's just a lot of fundamental misunderstanding, and also that the Blue Lives Matter, especially, you know, there's a difference when you're responding to someone saying Black Lives Matter. People are being killed. Police, being killed by police is a leading cause of death amongst Black men. Leading. Police kill 1,000 people a year. And so what the Black Lives Matter movement is doing, and I'm not the right person to talk about what the Black Lives Matter movement is doing as a white person, but from, you know, what really Black Lives Matter is saying is that we need to prioritize protecting Black lives right now, because they're not being prioritized at all. And so when you respond with All Lives Matter, or when you respond with Lives Matter, that's really seen as a kickback, as, well, I don't care about Black lives. I care about all. But in a lot of the All Lives Matter movements, also, I don't see any of those folks standing up for the kids in the border who are dying in detention centers. I don't see All Lives Matter people standing up for making sure that their neighbors have enough food or aren't getting kicked out of their homes. We need to really make sure that we are caring for each other as a community and not separating ourselves. And Black Lives Matter is really just, we have to focus on this issue because police killings have been brought up as a national public health emergency. The COVID-19 epidemic is affecting Black people at a much higher rate than white people. We need to be honest about that, and we need to say that. And so what All Lives Matter does is it dilutes that message, and it doesn't say we need to focus on Black lives. It's not a way that we can focus on the real harms in our society and help those people.
So speaking of the Blue Lives Matter movement, it seems like their opposite has been the defund the police movement. So what are the misconceptions about each of these movements, but also can they find common ground? Do you necessarily have to be against Blue Lives Matter if you support defunding the police, or can you support defunding the police and also be in support of law enforcement? And how do you try to bridge this gap?
I just don't think that Blue Lives Matter is the opposite of defund police. I think Blue Lives Matter is a smokescreen, because blue lives don't exist. That is a profession that people enter into. And we can talk about how professions, you know, folks need work in order to live in our society right now. But it's different. You can't quit being a Black person in America. You can't do that. And so as a job, it's changing the perspective and kind of a distraction technique, I think. There's a lot of room personally under the defund the police. I know that some people are not on the level of abolish the police. The NYCLU is not on our level right now. But I think that there's a lot of different ways that we can think about what defund the police to me really means is we need to reimagine and shift services, figure out where we're putting our priorities. And so I think that there's an opportunity to do that. And I also think that there are a decent amount of police officers who say, we don't want to be showing up to mental health crisis emergencies. We don't want to be doing all these extra things because you don't have the adequate training for that. And so we need to make sure if someone wants to support the police, that we make sure that they are doing the job that they have and not putting on all these extra responsibilities that are out of their purview. And then I think that as we get more towards redistributing where our budgets are, we could talk about what a police-free future looks like. And that is not something that is like tomorrow there's going to be zero police. But we can go down a road and we can think about what would happen if our communities cared for each other versus criminalized each other and ran after each other and beat each other up. So I think that's the huge shift that we have to do as a society. It's going to take a really long time and a lot of difficult conversations.
Yeah, and one of the themes that I have found in these difficult conversations is that we need to get comfortable having the uncomfortable discussions. Before we close out, we want to give you a moment. We're making this podcast on behalf of the youth group, and which is a group of overwhelmingly white high schoolers. And so we wanted to give you a minute to say any final thoughts you might have to this particular group of students.
I think you're going off on a great start. All of these questions have been really good. And to continue thinking about how to reduce harm and also change the systems that we have. I think it's important for folks with privilege to recognize where they have that privilege and to make sure that they're showing up in a way that's not racist, but actively anti-racist. So that means the difference on that is that there's an, that passive versus active. So we want folks to be stepping up actively. If someone says something racist in your vicinity, you can say, that's racist. Why did you say that? That is actually conversations with the people around you is one of the most effective ways to change minds. A lot of people, you know, I've gotten into a lot of Facebook arguments or arguments on social media, and you know, every once in a while, someone does change their mind a little bit, but it is very rare. And that's because people aren't having conversations with people they care about face to face. What we can really do is start to talk with our families, our friends, our neighbors. Ask why. Why is an amazing question. If someone says, well, you know, we can't do that, ask why. Why can't we do that? If someone says something racist, you could say, why did you think that was an appropriate or a funny thing to say? Usually there's not a great answer to that. I think those little steps are really important for folks to start bringing into their communities, because it's not an active confrontation. It's just saying, let's dig into that a little bit more. There's something that's going to be happening. And also just to really continue to work in your communities, get outside of your comfort zone, and make sure that you're learning as much as you can about how to be an active and engaged and less harmful member of your community. I think that's really what's going to help us change what's happening right now.
Well, Director Helmo, it has been so interesting and inspiring to speak with you today. And just thank you so much for joining us and you know, inspiring us, truly.
Thank you so much. And if anyone has questions, they can feel free to reach out to me. My email is lhermo, L-H-E-R-M-O, at nyclu.org. I'm always happy to help folks who have questions about activism or how to get more involved. So thank you so much. Really appreciate it.
All right. And thank you again. Everyone, stay tuned. We will be back next week with more of Peace, Police, and Everything in Between.